Is it constitutional to kill an American citizen if you're their government? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Institute for Principled Policy Executive Director Barry Sheets. And along with me today, as usual, is our Chief Engineer and the Vice Chairman of our organization, Chuck Michaelis.
And as always, I'm glad to be here with you, Barry.
Glad to have you here, Chuck. Today, we're going to be discussing something that has been in the news, but we neither Chuck nor I have seen how any of our news outlets have taken a look at the constitutional issues involved in this particular scenario. The scenario I'm talking about, and what you may be familiar with, was the event that happened on September the 30th of this year, when an American unmanned plane, was sent to take out, in the life of, assassinate an American citizen. Now, that American citizen's name was Anwar al-Awlaki, who happened to be an American by birth, was born in New Mexico in 1971, but who, through his training and through his belief system, had become an Islamist and had moved to Yemen and would consider himself a Yemeni American, and who, from his base in Yemen, was helping to plan operations for the group Al-Qaeda, who have been sending attacks against citizens, U.S. personnel, etc. As a matter of fact, Awlaki has been connected to the Fort Hood shooter, Nidal Malik Hassan, and the Christmas Day bomber, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab. And I know I'm butchering those names.
Yeah, isn't he also known as the underwear bomber?
The underwear bomber, yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
So, obviously, just for putting it on the record and laying it out there right up front, Anwar al-Awlaki was not a nice guy, okay? He had an entirely foreign belief system. He believed in the idea of jihad, total war against the United States of America, the land of his birth.
But wasn't Awlaki one of the guys who, in the early days of 9/11, wasn't he one of the go-tos for the quote-unquote more reasoned voice of the Islamic, you know, the Islamic belief system?
So in other words, when they were looking for a moderate Islamist to be able to spin the situation so that Islam itself would not be put on the examining table, but just a handful of radicals would be. Was he the guy that they went to? He was one of them, yes.
Yeah, I seem to recall seeing interviews with him early on in which he, you know, he took great pains to say not all Islam believes the same thing as these people do, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that would be part of his MO, but as he grew into the hierarchy of Al-Qaeda, he became a regional commander for them and actually was preparing and planning attacks against U.S. citizens, against U.S. holdings. Now, we have to stop here for a moment and understand something. There has been a lot of debate, discussion, right out rancorous argument sometimes, if you will, over whether or not the United States was justified in the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki. But we can't answer that question, Chuck, by just looking at the headlines in the newspaper. I mean, we know this gentleman's MO. We know his background, at least to some extent. Now, we won't know his whole background. We don't know how his influences when he was a child, things of that nature. Although I'm sure that we'll hear a official word on that sooner or later from government officials. But what we do have to do is we have to take what we do know about him, about his actions, and about his situation, that he was, by birth, an American citizen. And we need to look at that in light of the fact that we are a nation that is supposed to abide by a rule of law. We're a nation that is supposed to have an underpinning in a written body of rules.
And as we've gone over here from time to time, that also means we have a higher standard of behavior. One of the things that we lose when we lose that on a Christian worldview and of government is the fact that there is a higher standard and it does have to be obeyed. Then all of a sudden it becomes, do we want revenge rather than justice?
And you know, before anybody goes to flip off the radio dial and saying these guys are unpatriotic, un-American, et cetera, we want to unpack this. We want to think about this. Now, number one, we're not saying just full out America was right, love it or leave it, and yeah. therefore anything that we do can be wrapped and bathed in the red, white, and blue, and it's perfectly okay. But on the other hand, we're also not sitting here saying, oh, it's patently, he was a U.S. citizen, so it's patently wrong, and that's case closed, end of discussion, and we can't do anything.
Yeah, that's sort of a little too black and white approach to it. We really do have to unpack some of these things. I think you and I would both concur that Alaki was a really bad guy.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that, Chuck.
And if he could have been captured, his act was treasonous. And he could have easily, if we still had the death penalty for treason, which I'm not sure that we do, and that's a real consideration in this case too, because he was giving aid and comfort and making war against the United States. But the fact is, he should have been captured and tried and then executed.
Yes, well, you know, that would be the standard of operation. But what we had in this instance wasn't a capture, wasn't a brought before a tribunal or a jury. It wasn't comprised of a panel of his peers, as we talk about under our constitutional form of government.
He wasn't indicted by a grand jury.
He didn't have the case pronounced against him of what the specific charges were, things of that. Now, remember, folks, the reason why this is important that we're bringing this up is because that Alaki was an American citizen. Now, as far as I know, until I see something different, I don't see anywhere where he renounced his American citizenship or was expatriated by the country and had his citizenship removed from him. Now, that may come up sooner or later, and if it does, then that changes the picture slightly. But right now, we have to deal with what we have in front of us as fact. And the fact was that in 1971, Anwar Alaki was born in the United States as an American citizen. Therefore, as a citizen, he was entitled to all the rights and privileges and protections of an American citizen. Now, this American citizen, like some of our American citizens during the War for Independence, chose to align themselves with another sovereign.
Well, there have been American citizens throughout our history of wars and conflicts who have aligned themselves with other sovereigns. Tokyo Rose, for instance.
Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
The Rosenbergs during World War I. Some people thought that Eugene V. Debs was traitorous, although that's questionable, and he did serve time in prison under a very constitutionally questionable sedition law that in itself has many problems to it.
But we're not going to go back and re-argue the Alien Sedition Acts on today's program, but what we are going to bring up, and Chuck's bringing up a good point, is we have to do these things. We have to analyze this. And as a nation, we must make our decisions, especially when it's relating to an issue such as this, in relation to the fact that we have a rule of law that we swear all of our elected officials, from President Barack Obama down to our 435 House members and our 100 senators, raise their hand, put their hand on a Bible, and swear to. They swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. That document, the operating document for our liberties, is the thing that we have to turn to when we look at this. Let's not let our feelings necessarily drive how we look at this. Let's not let what our opinion about whether or not Alaki was a bad guy or not, even though it's fairly obvious he was, let not that be the color of how we approach this. Let's not let how we think about it, or even if we think we believe it, let's be careful and go back to the document. Let's go back and see what the Constitution says about how we as Americans and our elected officials, as those people who are carrying out that operation of government, even in this particular area of dealing with treachery.
Well, it's very important that we not allow our emotions to carry us away. All of us, I think, are patriotic almost to a fault. And sometimes I know I knee-jerk into when I read something that strikes me as blatantly anti-American, I immediately knee-jerk and I'm like, I don't want to read the rest of this. But then again, I want to read the rest of it so I understand the argument and see if the person has at least a grain of truth inside the what I consider a coating of incorrect thinking. And sometimes I get surprised and find out that my initial impression is wrong. So I have to stop and slow down and think about it rather than approaching it from an emotional standpoint.
Certainly. And I think at least in this particular, and I think this case is a good microcosm, a good tutorial, if you will, on how to look at an issue constitutionally. Because it seems like we have at least four distinct issues we must deal with here. First and foremost is, who declares war?
Well, that's
because,
right.
Because this is an act of war in one sense, because we flew unmanned drone planes in a foreign country and took out an individual who was under the protection of that foreign nation, under their flag. You know, as I said, he's considered a Yemeni American. Number two, once we determine who declares war, then we have to determine how it's carried out. What are the standards and rules by which we engage in warfare? Do we believe in total war in this country? Do we believe in a scorched earth strategy? Or do we believe in trying to have the most effect with the least amount of collateral damage? The third thing we have to look at is what in our rules of law gives us the ability to be able to say, well, yes, this is an American citizen, but because of his actions, we have the right or the duty to take the action that was taken on September the 30th. And the fourth issue we have to deal with is, if we've dealt with all those three issues, were we correct in executing that sentence upon that American citizen in that way on foreign soil?
And we also need to keep in mind that there are a number of critics of the current Constitution who would say, well, we need to change the Constitution to deal with situations like this. And I think you and I are going to unpack the idea that maybe there's already a mechanism in place to handle things like this in terms that our forefathers did understand, because we see it very early in the Republic.
Yes, and we're going to be talking about that more tomorrow when we come back into this, because we want to look at each of these four areas we talked about in more specific detail. But right now, you know, we have the situation in front of us. The action has been taken. The event has been completed. The question is now, how do we, as Americans who love liberty and who have stand by rule of law, how do we go about effectively answering the question, are we right? We'll talk about that more tomorrow on the next edition of Principles and Policies.
Join us tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Next is a constitutional commentary from the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
Recently, a friend asked me why conservatives always seem to begin any argument by completely capitulating to the underlying premise of the liberal position. He was understandably frustrated that once this capitulation of principle takes place, the argument is essentially lost. Of course, he's right, and this belies the basic flaw of conservative politics. Conservatives are always losers because they don't apply the fixed standard of the Bible or the Constitution. Instead, they argue for a lesser version of the liberal agenda. And so even when they win, we lose. An example of this is evident in the mosque at Ground Zero issue. The liberal, Harry Reid, has said that he respects the fact that Muslims have a First Amendment right to religious freedom. The conservative, Sarah Palin, says, we all know that they have the right to do it, but should they? Of course, they're both wrong. The First Amendment says that the Congress can't prohibit the free exercise of religion, but the word religion means an orthodox denomination of biblical Christianity. It doesn't mean Hinduism or Buddhism or Mohammedism. Here's what Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story wrote way back in 1833.
The real object of the First Amendment was not to countenance Mohammedism or Judaism or infidelity, but to exclude all rivalry among Christian denominations.
So, there exists no constitutional right to worship Allah. By accepting this false premise of the left, the right loses for us again. This is Michael Anthony Perutka for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American View.